Welcome to the Giving Black podcast. This podcast is proudly sponsored by Agency Inc. and the Avast Foundation. Agency is an international B Corp certified consulting company offering intelligent philanthropic solutions to socially and environmentally conscious organizations around the world. The Avast Foundation works in partnership with people and communities to knock down barriers to digital freedom and equity. Programs deliver meaningful change and help shape a world where technology plays a positive role in building and sustaining communities.
Good morning, Giving Black family. Good afternoon and good evening, wherever in the world you are listening to this podcast. I am so pleased to be able to introduce to you today Dr. Keratiloe Mogotsi, Program Director and Executive of Education. Dr. Keratiloe Mogotsi is a pracademic, a researcher, a Lean Six Sigma coach, a project management professional, PMP, and a lecturer. She is the Program Director for Executive Education at the Center of African Philanthropy and Social Investment at the Wits Business School in Johannesburg. She holds a PhD in African philanthropy, and her research areas include disaster philanthropy, venture philanthropy, African philanthropy, and philanthrocapitalism in Africa. Dr. Mogotsi, welcome to the Giving Black podcast. Thank you so much for joining us in conversation today. Let me kick off by asking you, how are you today?
Well, it is a good evening from Johannesburg, a chilly one. We are entering our winter and I'm very warm. So, you know, us in this part of the world, when there's a slight breeze, we get all the socks and all the scarves and the blankets out. So I'm ready for the winter.
Oh, my goodness. I tell you, if you want to talk about winter, come to Toronto in the month of January or February when we are basking in glorious minus 20 and on a warm day, glorious minus 10. But I get the image. I know when I go to Nigeria during the Harmattan around December, people are out in woolen coats and jackets and polo necks. And I'm wearing like a t-shirt just perspiring like there's no tomorrow. It's all relative.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Dr. Mogotsi, tell us a little bit about yourself and the work that you do.
Great. So I like to just provide a full context. I'm a mother, first of all. I have a 12-year-old daughter. I'm a wife and I'm a teacher. So you mentioned all those things that I do at the Wits Business School. It just describes the various types of responsibilities that I tap into. So I am a teacher and I'm a teacher of African philanthropy. I help students with their research that could be at master's level, at PhD level, and also teach. We provide a number of courses in African philanthropy now at the Wits Business School. And I supervise students from all over the continent that I've been working with ever since moving into the space in 2019, which is when I met you, Mide, in 2019 at the beginning of my journey.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And let me kind of state also for the benefit of our listeners that you are a contributor to the Duality of Giving Agency's research into philanthropy on the African continent and amongst African diaspora. And I've always been struck since we started our relationship back in 2019 at how you practice your own philanthropy. Yes, certainly. I mean, you are a powerful thought leader in the world of African philanthropy, but also I know that you hold those values dear to your heart as well. So help us to understand, how did philanthropy hit you at first? What is your earliest memory of philanthropy?
Oh, it could be as early as I can remember. They say in science that we can remember up to like 3 years, 4 years. And I have vivid memories of how we were always a lot. So my direct family, that is my mother and my father's children, there's two of us actually, directly for my mom and my dad. And then my dad had his son coming into the marriage. My mom had her son coming into the marriage. My mom has 11 other siblings who were all deputy moms and deputy fathers. She actually, it's a family of women. There's 9 girls out of that 12. And my uncles were much younger. They came in at number 9, number 12, and I think the other one was number 10. So they were much younger in the pack. So growing up, we used to spend our holidays. We always knew that you're going to one of the mom's houses. So sometimes I didn't know which one, but we knew that every holiday season we would end up at one of their houses. When we got there, you cook, we share all our food. I mean, at any given time, there were always at least 10 people in the household, but we ate our food. Sometimes they would put all our food together for us in our plates, and then we shared food together. So sharing and giving, which is what we understand better in African languages, has been there from the onset as a child and even as growing up. My wedding was quite a phenomena because we initially wanted a small private wedding with my husband, and we told the families that we want a small intimate thing. But when the day came, I saw all of my mom's friends there and people from the church and all of my dad's friends there and people from his background. So I don't even know how many people ended up coming up for the wedding. It was not an intimate small wedding at all. But we embrace it because it's who we are. You don't forget where you came from. You don't forget who you grew up with. And we tend to be each other's keepers. So we keep in touch at major events like deaths, births, marriages, and the like.
Wow. So for you, as they say, that philanthropy began at home, charity began at home with the example set by family. And I suspect that that was such an indelible upbringing that you had, you know, just observing these acts of generosity. But how did you then make a decision to follow philanthropy as a line of study and practice and into academia? Because I must say, you're quite rare. And I think for a lot of our listeners today, some may be surprised that on the African continent, we actually study, unpick, analyze philanthropy on our continent and in our respective countries to better understand it. That may be kind of fresh news to some of our listeners who may be more inclined to think about Africa as the continent that receives philanthropy rather than the continent that kind of studies philanthropy. And of course, both are true, but one narrative is dominant over another.
And partaking in philanthropy, right? So to be honest, I never understood the term. So I knew it. I mean, I've probably had heard it somewhere in the news. I'd probably heard of Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and stuff like that. So that's where I positioned it. I actually began my whole career as a project manager. So I was working in the corporate space. I worked for a research company. I worked for Eskom, which makes the electricity for us here in South Africa. I did some work with them as well. So I was very much the corporate girl, going to meetings, doing business analysis documents and all of that. When I turned 30, Mide, I just felt very dissatisfied with life. I was waking up, hitting the traffic, going to work, do my job and come back, feed the baby, feed everyone at home, go back, sleep and do the whole thing all over again. So I spent a couple of weeks thinking, is this all there is to it, that I'm going to do this every day, get older, retire, die? I don't want this. At the time, I was working for a research company, and I was asking myself, who is the shareholder of this company? Who am I chasing the invoices and payments to? Because we were selling research data to FMCG companies. So I just felt like it was all futile, and I didn't want to use my time like that. So I quit. I didn't know where I'm going or what's the next plan. I just knew that I don't like this conveyor belt, because that's how I felt, that every day was the same. And I didn't know why I was doing what I was doing, even though I studied it. So I quit, spent a couple of months unemployed. Because I had a master's degree, I would get like small gigs to teach a short course here and to teach a course there. Then I realized that I actually enjoy teaching and preparing for class. They were not paying me a lot, and it wasn't a full-time position, but I did enjoy the little that I did in gigs. Then I started searching for work and came across an advert from the Center of African Philanthropy. I said, what is this? It was different from all the other adverts that were available. I was like, a Center for African Philanthropy. Let me investigate this. And then I applied. I went for the interview. I got the job. And starting that job was an eye-opener for me, because I then got exposed to the NGO world. I met really passionate people all over the African continent, in Kenya, in Ghana, in Nigeria, that are doing really amazing things for communities. Some were helping children. Some were helping women that have been victims of gender-based violence. I just felt, wow, this is something to wake up to. So I could explain why I'm going to work. I'm going to work to help all these fabulous people do the work that they're doing. So as they always say, the rest is history. I just sort of felt I found the meaning that I was looking for. The search has stopped. My dissatisfaction paused right there, because I finally found something that gives me the kick. And then I decided to study it. So I went all in, hands, feet, everything. I was like, I really want to do this thing. So I studied it, did my PhD, graduated, and then I applied to join the academic team. And here I am. I'm now teaching it.
What a fascinating journey. Wow. Amazing. From selling research for a fast-moving consumer goods organization to dropping the mic, quitting your job, and just saying, this isn't for me. And as you mentioned, Dr. Mogotsi, you have a PhD in philanthropy. And I wonder if you could expand a little bit more, for the benefit of myself and our listeners, your area of study and specialism, and anything that you may have learned that would be useful for us to know about African philanthropy, or philanthropy on the African continent, or even amongst Africa's diaspora.
Yeah, so I started in 2019. So I came in through the job. And in the job, I was managing programs, because I was a project manager, right? So I was managing programs for the Center of African Philanthropy. So we would go to a lot of conferences and workshops. Sometimes we would get invited, or we would initiate them. And at the time in 2019, there were a lot of strange things happening on the African continent. We had a massive drought. So it was very hot. And I remember my son was very sensitive to the heat as well. So we had to, and he couldn't have as much water as he needed to. But it was extremely hot. Then it would get cold. Then it would start raining. Then we had cyclones, heavy cyclones that hit a number of countries in the Southern African region. So around April in 2019, there was a really big cyclone, Cyclone Idai, that happened. And it caught everybody off guard. We've always had rains and flooding and stuff, but that one caught everybody off guard, the magnitude and the impact, the strength that it had. It destroyed bridges, roads, houses, and took many people's lives as well. So in the aftermath of that cyclone, we decided to summon all the civil society leaders in the Southern African region to come together, because it was complete chaos what happened after that. As you know, a disaster is traumatic. The first phase of it is focusing on rescuing people, getting them out of the water. Then you need to find alternative shelter because everything had been washed away. So we convened the civil society leaders just to unpack all the issues and processes that are in place. And we realized that we're actually not prepared for these kind of big impact disasters. We've been very fortunate. I'm actually quite grateful where we live. We don't have impact like Japan or heavy earthquakes and cyclones frequently like those regions. But Cyclone Idai was a big one. So we acknowledge that civil society is not ready. Governments also are not ready. And the corporate sector are not ready. So in taking part in all of these discussions, I realized that, hold on a second, I'm a project manager. I'm a Lean Six Sigma expert. So processes and systems is what I've been helping companies to do when I was in the corporate world. Would that not be helpful here? Can I not help them to derive like process maps and value chains to make sure that there's no duplication of efforts when we're responding to a disaster? Because the thing with civil society is that we're very passionate about the cause, you know, like helping children, helping the disaster victims. But in terms of collaboration and integrating efforts, Cyclone Idai needed that. It needed heavy communication and collaboration between all the players that came to respond. So I got my inspiration right there and I decided to do my PhD on it. I took the business principles that I had learned and practiced as well for a number of years in corporate. I said, can I use this in the nonprofit space? Can we use this Lean Six Sigma processes to derive a process map of what do you do leading to the disaster, during the disaster, and after. So that's what I studied. And then unknowingly to me, COVID was coming. So 2019, we were dealing with the cyclone and the drought. Then all of a sudden, everybody had to be locked at home. And again, civil society was found unprepared for it. How do you work remotely? How do you continue doing this great social impact work remotely? So I found myself falling into the sustainable development space, climate change, even though my focus was on how to use business processes in the philanthropy space. I found that all of that is highly applicable with the global sustainability challenges that we face today.
I want to talk about that a little bit, and thank you for sharing. I think there are two things that you mentioned that really I'm curious about. The first is an African-centered response to disaster management. I have to say, in almost 30 years of being in the nonprofit world and working with global organizations, this is the first time that I'm learning that Africans on the continent are creating their own solutions to issues of climate change. The second is Africa's response to the COVID-19 outbreak. I remember reading articles in some of the world's most famous newspapers and journals to say that, listen, COVID-19 will absolutely devastate the African continent, perhaps reduce population size by about 25%, that it was going to ravage the continent. None of which was true, actually. Of all the continents in the world, the African continent was probably amongst the least affected by COVID-19. And I know that that is because, again, within Africa, Africans were devising their own health management plans in terms of how to deal with COVID-19. So I wonder if you could touch on, please, just for my benefit and the benefit of our listeners who do not necessarily reside on the African continent, how do these management systems take place and how are they rolled out? What is it that makes them so successful on the African continent?
Yeah, so it's very important to highlight that there's what is called indigenous knowledge systems in Africa. We have our ways of doing things. A lot of the times these are not documented, and it's not the science that you think about. You know, you think of science and you think of a lab and somebody in a white coat and stuff like that. We have indigenous knowledge systems that work brilliantly, Medem. I'll give you a few examples. So when I was pregnant with my first daughter, I didn't know I was pregnant. We had a family get together and my grandmother was there. I didn't sit with her or anything. She just took one look at me. And then a few days later, my mom called me and she said, my grandmother spoke to her and said that I'm pregnant. Then I said, oh, then I went to test and yes, I am. And then when I went to her, I asked her, this is a woman who didn't finish standard 5, which is grade 5, I think, mm-hmm. which is grade 5 there. So primary schooling, she didn't get through that. She's no scientist. She's never worn a coat lab. She took one look at me and she knew that I was pregnant. I asked her, I said, how did you know? And she said, my ears. Look, I can't do it right now, but she says there's something about the ears of a pregnant woman that they're able to read.
Yeah. Wow.
They also knew how to read weather and temperatures. They also like could do their own weather forecasting mechanism, right? When it rained a lot, they knew the kind of plant that you need to put out there, which herb you need to apply on yourself when you're not feeling well. During COVID, we were all steaming. We would, make little concoctions and then you cover with a blanket. You put it in hot water, cover yourself with the blanket to clear your airways. So all of that, if you read the science, the scientific terms, you realize that it is actually science, but they didn't learn it in the classroom. They learned it because people that lived here before us would have dealt with similar ailments or issues that they passed on from generation to generation. I'll have you know that some of the first vaccines were created here in Africa. It's just that we don't trust and we don't believe when it comes from here. But when the news broke up of some solution to COVID, it was a guy in Madagascar, somewhere in Africa, who had come up with the concoction to assist with that. When I had my baby, my grandmother sent a number of herbs and things that she grounded for herself. Some of it was to help me to get my strength back. Others helped for the milk production to come out. None of it from the pharmacy, Mide, or from the hospital. It's herbs that she knew. She was taught by her own mother that this plant can help you with this and this one can help you with that. It's only now we are starting to realize scientifically the uses of some of these things. And I'll give cannabis as an example. It's getting legalized in different countries now. That plant alone treats so many ailments. Right. It's been illegal because of the abuse. And we always focus on the abuse and the THC content and stuff like that. But Africans know that it helps with asthma. So if a child has an asthmatic problem, they can use the herbs and the CBD found in that plant assist with an asthma attack, right? So there's lots of scientific knowledge that sits in our elders, especially because they know all of these things that they've learned that we need to tap into. So when COVID came, the focus wasn't there's this word called COVID. It was more of there's something that spreads with contact, right? In some African places, you don't have access to running water. So the solutions were wash your hands, social distance, and all of that. In some villages and places in Africa, you don't have that access to water. But they have their own ways to treat infections. They have their own ways to social distance and to practice hygiene without using the running water that we're all used to. So we survived because we have inherent knowledge of how to take care of ourselves and how to look after ourselves. It's just that knowledge is not being fully utilized or taken advantage of because it's a wealth of wisdom and science that sits in our elderly generation.
So here we have a climate disaster. We have a health disaster. What role did African philanthropy play in mitigating the impacts of those two disasters? What were you seeing as an expert on the ground around how philanthropy on the continent was, if you like, contributing to the alleviation of suffering or setting up of systems?
So what I saw actually is that philanthropy is a key contributor and a key responder in all the disasters that I interviewed and what I continue to observe today and historically as well. Now, why, you ask yourself? So technically, and in the literature, you'll learn that governments are responsible for a country, right? So that's the first point of contact. If something happens, it's the government's responsibility to administer what happens next. The corporate sector and the civil society sector and nonprofits are supposed to technically assist. But what I found is that they played a much bigger role in all the sites that I visited. And that's simply because of the magnitude of the disaster that happened. Philanthropic organizations have more flexibility and they're able to decide faster, you know, like, okay, we need an extra this much money channeled to rescue operations or channeled to shelter. And then in 5 days, you should have that. Whereas with the African governments, you'll find that a cyclone can move across Mozambique, Madagascar, Malawi, Zimbabwe, maybe even parts of South Africa as well, and very different responses and capabilities from all of those governments. So it takes much longer to coordinate and to gazette and make decisions and to raise funds for our administrators. For corporates, you find that although a lot of them do operate in a lot of countries as well, they do like cause-related marketing. So they can also respond quicker. But remember, corporates are not in business to respond to disasters per se. So they will assist if they have to or if circumstances permit. They are there to make profits and to run business, unless their business was also flushed down or heavily impacted there. So it left the philanthropic responders. Some of the first responders were from and nonprofit institutions, whether they're international, local, or grassroots organizations. They were there on the scene saving people. They were there on the scene creating the shelters and providing the aid that's provided. So they are a key contributor to response. Now, what's required is that government still needs to maintain that authority and administration. But because we have so many philanthropic organizations, whether it's a community foundation, an INGO, which is an international NGO, they all come to the scene. Something has happened, right? We see it on the news. People are drowning. They send their teams out there to respond. when everybody comes, who does what? What are we going to respond to? Because if we all bring rice and nobody brings the spoons to eat the rice, they can't consume that rice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because everything has been washed away. I mean, if you think about your own house right now, if everything was taken away and someone bought you a bag of rice, you can't cook it in your hand. You can't consume it. Okay, you can consume it with your hands, but it just makes the process much longer.
Even lighting the fire would be a problem.
Yes, because there's water everywhere, right? So you won't be able to light a fire to cook it. So just to coordinate that response and maybe do a consolidated needs assessment. Nonprofit organizations do their own needs assessment. But if I'm doing something as my organization and your midday, you come with your team and you do your own thing, if we don't share notes, we might end up doing the same thing and completely neglecting another need, something which the community desperately needed. So for just a classic example, some of the community members there were expressing that they lost all of their medications. You know, people on chronic medication, sanitary towels and all of that, they lost. So of course, food is most critical. The food came in abundance. And then later on, we realized, okay, there's still medications and sanitary towels. So you find that there's a bit of back and forth before we can get the people assisted. And in duplicating efforts, some things go to waste, right? So if you don't distribute all that rice that has come, eventually the water will get through, it will get destroyed, and it's not consumable any longer. So that coordination, collaboration is highly important. And then do you know that there's a lot of competition and rivalry as well in the nonprofit sector? It's not something that we obviously celebrate. It's human nature, I suppose. So it's not easy to do that collaboration and to share notes in order to respond effectively. But it's necessary because philanthropic actors are always on the scene, sometimes being the first to be able to assist people that are in need and to move communities and spread education.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to learn from you in terms of how did philanthropists respond? And you know, it's a bit of a pointed question because often I believe, my kind of line of work and inquiry and study, we often believe that philanthropy, as far as Africa is concerned, comes from outside of the continent, not from within the continent. And I was keen to know if there are examples, perhaps, that you may share that you observed of philanthropy generated within the continent, much like you were speaking of those indigenous skills and knowledge about health and the use of herbs for healing. Did you see a uniquely African response to the disasters?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, remember that philanthropy is not only giving money. It's also giving of your time, giving of your resources, giving of your talent. So all of that happened because before responders come, guess who is responding first? The survivors, the people themselves help each other, right? The people themselves mobilize each other. There was a classic, beautiful example from Malawi. And if you look at the statistics of Cyclone Idai, they had less fatalities. Even though the cyclone was still heavy there, they did have less fatalities. Now, what the people of Malawi did is that flooding is a common thing. They spread education and awareness. So a young child knows that if water goes to that level, you don't wait for it to flood and get to your level. When water has passed a certain level on the river, I need to go upstream or I need to go to a highland area. They know that because they've been educated and the awareness was created by the communities and the community leaders themselves. So they self help and they self-teach each other of how do you respond and what do you do when a circumstance like this happens.
Yeah.
So what happened in Malawi is that people mobilized, and then those who were not able to move, they were assisted to move to those higher ground areas, and that saved their lives. People also help each other with resources, because in some cases it took days before the food or the shelter came. So if your home was still intact, they were taking people in, providing that shelter, accommodation, food as well to survivors. We're very good in contributing here in Africa. We have a lot of names for it, and we contribute for everything. We contribute for weddings. We contribute for funerals. We contribute in times of stress. And the beauty of it is that you don't need to advertise or to market. If you hear that there's a funeral at home and it's someone that you knew, even if it's not your direct brother or sister, the fact that you know them, you know that you need to pack your bag and to go. Because you are required there, not only to give money, but your time to help to cook, to help with all of the arrangements that need to be there. So before international organizations come and the media coverage came, people were already doing it for themselves on the ground. And I would say a lot of lives were saved in those few days because of our solidarity and not needing that push to know that you need to assist somebody with whatever resources that you have. We have a thing here where if you're cooking, right, and you're making yourself a nice dish and realize that your salt has run out, you're not embarrassed to knock next door and say, I need some salt, you know, and they'll help you and come and share the meal with you as well. So it's not shameful to ask for help. It's not shameful to give help as well. The urge came, and that really helped to save a lot of people's lives.
I love the way that you describe the removal of shame. Of course, in what we know about other forms of philanthropy, there seems to be a kind of divide between the one who gives and the one who receives. And I think that what you were explaining, perhaps uniquely about the philanthropy that we see on the African continent, is this freedom, this kind of liberation from shame, and more linked to traditional customs of wanting to help each other, no matter what large way, as a multi-country disaster, or in the small way of, I've run out of salt and, I'm just going to knock on the door of my neighbor, rather than hop in my car and drive to the supermarket 2 miles away, to mitigate any form of embarrassment. I think that is what fascinates me so much about African philanthropy, the intimacy, the intimate nature of the relationship between those who give and those who receive, and understanding that even for those who receive, they also perpetuate giving in different circumstances. So it's never a binary act, right? Final point of conversation, I would say, and thank you so much just for providing such tremendous insight and background. My question, because you are an academic also, is to maybe ask you, when you think about African philanthropy, what are maybe some of the thoughts that you may have in terms of the direction that it is traveling in? In my own observation, there seems to be a number of channels. The first, which I think is growing, is to transform African philanthropy to how we see philanthropy in the global north. That is to set up these very formalized systems. Our millionaires and billionaires are writing these massive checks, and they're using and leveraging photo opportunities to increase their profile, naming buildings, etc. And then, to your point, there is the everyday act of philanthropy of people like you and I that continually gets overlooked. and is not written about, is not recognized. Where do you see philanthropy on the African continent going, say, over the next decades and certainly into the future? What might you share with our listeners in terms of what we might expect as the evolution of African philanthropy?
I'm very excited about where philanthropy is going. I'm excited about where it's going because of where it's coming from. You must understand that Africa has a very deep history. So if we had a period of pre-colonial times, how Africa was before the colonization period. You will know that we were one continent. So a lot of these borders that we have today, it was as a result of the 1884 Berlin Conference, where they shared the land amongst themselves.
They being the European colonizers,
yes,
who
yeah, yeah, the
in
colonizers,
1884
the colonizers.
Came up with the Berlin Agreement, which essentially turned the African continent into a grid reference map, and each of the squares within that grid was allocated to a European colonizer, and then African countries were formed from that grid reference.
100%, 100%. And it also made us speak different languages. So Nigeria, South Africa, we got the English influence. You meet up with brothers from DRC and the like, they speak French. So before that happened, we were in the pre-colonial era. What was life like then? A lot of history books don't delve into that. But as philanthropy educators, we are going back there. We are going out there to let the world know that the richest man who has ever lived in this world to this day, Bill Gates has nothing on him, is Mansa Musa of Mali, who lived in the area which is now Mali and Benin areas there before they put the borders in place. What was life like there? We lived in empires. There was abundance and rich. The giving was also abundant. People would share cows. He would share gold. They say that Mansa Musa gave away so much gold that he devalued the value of gold because of the amount of gold that he gave away. Then the colonial period came. We all got influenced differently, and it also affected our laws and manners in which things operate. And that's when the Western type of philanthropy started coming in, people coming into Africa to provide assistance. Fast forward, let's say 2000 to normal times, which is contemporary times of philanthropy. All African states, aside from the one in Morocco, have gained their independence. All of them are plus minus 30 years old into independence. And I'm excited now. Why? Because we are moving towards where we came from. We are moving towards to that one Africa market, free movement of goods and people. If you read the letter that Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma wrote to Kwame Nkrumah, she wrote it as a futuristic letter to him in 2063, where Africa will be. And she speaks about free movement of goods and people. She speaks about the young people having voices in all aspects of life. She speaks about trade and industry growing and us finally tackling our unemployment challenge. So we're no longer that image of a hungry person with a begging bowl. Slowly, Africa is starting to take its place and we are bringing philanthropy home because this is where it came from. So all of these concepts that we study and that we speak about, that we teach, we in our institution are showing their African roots and their the ways in which they manifest themselves on our continent. So in the next decade or so, there should be a very good realization of where philanthropy comes from. There should be a very solid foundation of scholars and practitioners as well, who are based in Africa, who are practicing for the African continent as well. And there will now be African givers. We will give to Europe. We will give to you guys in Canada as well, because every resource comes from here. So we are getting high net worth individuals coming up fast and furious, some of the richest people are here in Africa, there's a diversity of things that you can be successful in. So in sport, in energy, in the minerals, whatever the case may be, slowly but surely we are getting there. And then the tables will turn.
Wow. That's what excites me so much about Africa. That's the way that the continent is now. The culture, the food, the environment, the people, and what Africa will continue to evolve to become. One day, I fundamentally believe, a global world leader. And mm-hmm. and one steeped in, to your point, mm-hmm. our indigenous values, going back to how things were pre-colonization. That is a dream that we all ought to have and a work that we all ought to pursue and contribute to. And I'm excited about the role of philanthropy in making that world a reality. Wow, what a conversation. Dr. Keratilowe Mgodsi, thank you so much for being so generous with your time and your thoughts. It's been a pleasure to speak with you on this episode of the Giving Black podcast. I thank you. I look forward to our continued relationship building and to continue to learn from you as you uncover much more than we already know today about African philanthropy. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mide. I like to close with a saying. It's a Portuguese saying, a luta continua. And if you followed a lot of the struggle songs, they brought that word that we continue. It says the struggle continues, but we continue to fight for Africa's rightful place. So thank you for having me, and a luta continua.
There's not much more I can say after that. If you have a story to share and tell and would like to be a guest on the podcast, drop me a line at mide@agency.ca. That's mide, M-I-D-E, at agency, agency.ca. And I'd be happy to look at your request and schedule a time to record with you. Thank you very much for listening. Looking forward to our next exciting guest for episode 10 of the Giving Black podcast. Stay tuned, stay blessed, and be well, everybody. Thank you.